This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
Tired of the everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton. How are y'all? Hey, I'm doing pretty well. Not much of interest to report. When does that ever stop me from yammering on and on and on? The first program tonight is actually an Australian import from Grace Gibson's Productions. The Clock. It debuted on November the 3rd of 1946 and would run for a bit more than a year, closing out production on May the 23rd of 1948, for a total of 65 shows. As I said, the show is an Australian import, but some troubles were made by Grace Gibson's production to make the series as generic as possible. The settings were everywhere, not particularly Australian, not particularly American. The actors were chosen for their lack of an Australian accent. All of this helped when it came time to try to market the program to the American audience. And marketed it was, successfully, to ABC. The show must have been reasonably successful for ABC because after Grace Gibson's productions discontinued the program in Australia, ABC continued for another 13 weeks with an American cast and completely American crew, producing 13 new scripts before closing the production down entirely, giving a total of 78 episodes for this program.
Sunrise and sunset, promise and fulfillment, birth and death. The whole drama of life is written in the sands of time.
We present a new series of radio programs, The Clock.
Nice to see you again. Pleasant to be back. Got a little time to spare? 30 minutes, maybe, by the clock? Funny thing about time, to some it's priceless, to others it has no value. It's the most perishable commodity in the world, and yet it lasts forever. If we lose it, we're unhappy, but we don't mind giving it away. For instance, there was young Joey. Have you ever heard of Joey Harper? Well, perhaps you haven't. He's a likable young fellow, though, alert, ambitious and cheerful. Well, usually cheerful, anyway. For even the best of dispositions can often change. I'd like to tell you about Joey. Will you listen? It might be worth your while. It's so amazing you may not believe it, although it could have happened to you.
Oh, listen, Lois, listen. You gotta listen. It wasn't my fault. Gee, honey, I love you. I wouldn't hurt you, Lois, for all the money in the world.
All the money in the world. Joey used those words before, but in a different way. Joey felt the money made the clock go round, and then everyone had it but him.
Joey?
Yeah?
What are you thinking about?
Your old lady.
What?
I mean your mother.
Oh. Gee, I'm sorry about what she said, Joey.
It's not your fault. Maybe I'll never have any more dough than I got right now. Maybe she's right, I'm just a bust.
Oh, don't say that, Joey. You've got to give yourself a little time.
Time? How much time do you think I got? I'm 22, Lois, practically middle-aged. I'll be tripping over my beard before I get a nickel in the bank.
Maybe it's your job, Joey.
Oh, no, it's not my job, Lois. I've done everything from selling insurance to driving a hack. But I always make the same amount, $35 a week.
You can't expect to be successful overnight.
Other guys can do it. Why can't I? You know, it's like a jinx. I work like a dog. I yell for raise. I stick my nose to the grindstone until it hurts. But it always comes out the exact same way, Lois. 35 smackers a week.
Everybody can't be rich, I guess. Everybody can't have $1 million.
I wish I was so rich that $1 million was just like chicken feed. I wish I had all the money in the world.
Joey?
Yeah?
Look at this window display. Oh, isn't that a lovely ring?
I'll say it is.
Which one are you looking at?
The one with all those diamonds.
Well, that's not the one I mean, silly. I'm talking about the gold one. The plain one over there. The wedding ring.
Oh.
I guess it isn't really very expensive, is it?
Well, who cares? We're not going to buy it.
Joey!
Oh, let's face it, Lois. You know your mother won't let you get married to me. She thinks I'm a lemon. She wants to settle her with cash.
We just have to be patient.
Barry Cannon's the guy for her. His old man's got dough. He'll own the business one of these days, and he'll be in solid. Me? I'm just a jerk.
Joey, please don't spoil the evening by talking that way.
Barry's the perfect son-in-law. He's got dough in his pocket and a new suit in his back. Even the fillings in his teeth are made of gold. And someday I'm going to knock them out one by one just to prove my point.
Joey, if you dare get into a fist fight with Barry Cannon, why, there he is. It's Barry in that car.
Hi there, sweetie.
Hello, Barry.
How goes it, Joe?
Pretty good. How'd you got here?
How do you like the bus?
Why, it's new, Barry.
Yeah, it's to be back 1500. It's got style.
Oh, I think it's lovely. Don't you, Joey?
It reminds me of a hearse.
Joey!
Still sore at the world, Joey?
Why don't you take that over-polished kitty car and go right home?
Joey, I wish you wouldn't be so rude.
Oh, that's all right, Lois. I don't bruise easily. Coming to my party on Friday night?
Well...
We're dressing, you know. It's formal.
Well, we're not going, Barry.
Well, if you're worried about the clothes, I can lend you my dinner jacket. I'm wearing tails.
You'd certainly look good with tails, Barry. Hanging from a tree.
Joey!
All right. If this guy appeals to you so much, Lois, I'll bow out. I'm sick and tired of hearing him talk about himself. And I'm sick and tired of hearing your family talk about me.
Hey, what is this? Lover's quarrel?
Barry, you driving uptown?
Sure.
Would you drop me off at my home?
Hop in.
When you're ready to apologize, Joey Harper, you can let me know.
Joey just stood there and watched Lois drive away. And he felt she didn't understand. The tragedies of youth can be painful things, mellowed only by time alone. If he could only have explained to Lois. If he could have only told her...
You don't know what it means, Lois, when a guy can't afford to buy his girl an engagement ring. When I take you to the movies, we always sit in the cheapest seat. After a while, Lois, it gets so you begin to think that money's the most important thing on earth. And you can't live without it. Sometimes you even feel you don't want to live without it.
Yes, if Joey could have told her that, the story might have been different. But he didn't. He had too much pride. So he merely watched the girl he loved drive away with another boy. Then he turned and walked slowly home. But every once in a while, he'd pause in front of a shop window and look hungrily inside.
Beautiful, aren't they?
What?
Those ermine wraps.
Huh. Cost a lot of dough.
In the next shop, they have a cigarette case made of solid gold.
You know, it'd take me a week to make enough money to even buy the boxes they come in.
That money won't bring you happiness.
That line was invented for laugh by the guys who got it.
Really?
And the laugh is on guys like me.
You're wrong, my boy.
Who says so? Who are you, anyway?
I beg your pardon. I didn't mean to intrude.
He was a little old man in a worn felt hat. And to Joey, he seemed as old as... well, time. He seemed to shuffle as he walked, as if his balance was bad, and Joey saw him start to cross the street. The light suddenly changed, and the heavy surge of traffic made the old man panicky. He started to run without looking around. And the driver in the bus turned the corner and didn't see him. And then Joey Harper bounded forward and made a flying dive. The two of them rolled over to the curb.
What happened?
You almost got killed, that's what. Here. Let me help you up.
Thank you. That bus, I didn't see that bus.
Look, mister. In New York, you watch where you go when you cross the street. Those 10-ton buses can make a permanent crease in your future.
Yes, I guess I'm not used to all this traffic, but you saved my life, young man.
Forget it.
No, young man, you saved my life. Not that it's worth very much to me, but I have a great capacity for gratitude.
Well, I guess you and I are in the same boat, Pop, when you say your life isn't worth very much.
But I'm old, and I have no one who cares. But you're young and strong. Why do you feel the way you do?
It's simple, Pop. I'm broke.
You mean you haven't got a job?
Well, I got a job. I can always get a job, but what good does it do? I'll never make enough to live the way I like.
How would you like to live?
You ever read The Count of Monte Cristo?
Yeah.
Well, that's the kind of dough I'd like to have. Not $1,000 or even a million. I'd like to have so much money there'd be no end to it. I'd like to wrap up the world in cellophane and stick it in the pocket like a pack of cigarettes.
Yes, but money isn't everything.
It's enough for me.
You see, I have the kind of money that you talk about. Unlimited quantities to do with as I please. I am the richest man who ever lived. But it doesn't make me happy.
Pop, you didn't crack your head on that curb, did you? You feel okay?
Where do you live, young man?
87 Nettle Street. Why?
What's your name?
Joey Harper.
My name is Pickering, and I'm going to reward you for saving my life.
You better keep your money, mister. You look like you need as much as me.
I said I'm going to reward you, Joey, and I mean it.
Yeah?
I'm going to give you all the money in the world.
Joey watched the old gentleman shuffle away, and in spite of his depression, Joey smiled. All the money in the world. Joey doubted if the old man had anything more valuable to give away than his time. But Joey didn't know how valuable the old man's time could be. A few minutes later, Joey reached his furnished room. He'd made a big decision. He was going away for good. He'd forgotten all about Mr. Pickering by the time he'd packed his bag, but when he opened the door to go, the old man was standing there with an envelope in his hand.
Good evening.
Oh, hello, Mr. Pickering.
Are you going somewhere?
I'm getting out of this town. For keeps, I'm through bucking the system. I know when I'm licked.
Do you have a minute to spare?
Sure. Come in.
Thanks. So this is where you live.
Yeah. Classy, isn't it?
Do you prefer more elaborate quarters?
And I'm going to get it, too. Tomorrow night I'll probably sleep in the park, and then I'll have plenty of room to move around.
I'd suggest a 4-story brownstone mansion. I believe there's one available right now. Of course, you'd have to arrange for a staff of servants, but that could be managed, too.
What are you trying to do? Give me a ride?
You can give it to me, Joey, when you get your limousine.
Well, right now I'm using the subway.
Joey! Come back, Joey.
Would you mind leaving me alone?
Come back, Joey, and open this envelope. It may change your mind about many things.
What's in that envelope?
When you open it, you'll see. But before you do, remember this is only a trickle. It's a drop in the bucket. There's more where that came from, lots more, and I promise you I'll keep you well supplied.
You must be nuts.
I have no more use for what you find in that envelope, Joey. I've achieved my goal, you see. I only hope it'll help you to achieve your own. Go on. Open it, Joey.
Hey! It's money!
$500,000 in $1,000 bills. It's yours, Joey. It's all yours.
Have you ever wished upon a star and had that wish fulfilled? It's common among mortal men. Joey knew the meaning of wish fulfillment when he stared at all the money on that table. For 5 full minutes, and I timed him personally, he didn't move. $500,000. And Mr. Pickering had said it was only a drop in the bucket.
What are you thinking of, Joey?
I...
Are you planning to do a lot with your money, or are you thinking of calling the police?
I just can't talk.
No, no, Joey. I didn't rob a bank or lift a payroll.
Then where'd you get the money?
Are you asking questions, Joey? Are you going to waste time in quibbling, or are you going out to satisfy every dream and every ambition you've ever had?
You're right, Mr. Pickering. I'm just a sap. I've been tearing my hair and beating my chest and praying for a break, and then when I get one, I'm scared.
Scared? What's there to be frightened about? You didn't steal anything. There's everything you've ever wanted on that table, and there's more to come. So why bother with questions? Grab it, Joey. Stuff it in your pockets. Go out and spend it.
You just watch my scene.
There's a store downtown, Joey. An expensive establishment that deals in boats. They have a yacht in the sale.
And that's the first on the list. I'll start with the expensive stuff and then work my way down the scale of the junk. Where's my hat? Oh, never mind. I'll buy a couple of dozen on the way down.
You.
That's a nice pub you got standing there, mister.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
And what's it cost?
Well, that yacht is our largest model. 90 feet, accommodates 14 people. Its cabins are completely furnished. It requires a crew of 6.
I ask what it cost.
$145,000. F-O-B.
I'll take it.
You what?
I said I'll take it.
And how will you pay for it?
In cash. $145,000. Any tax?
You got that cash in your pocket?
$145,000 on the nose. No tax?
The tax is included, sir.
Have it shipped to the Hudson River and let me know what pier. I'll give you my address and you just give me a receipt. And if you're a nice boy, I'll come around and buy another one. When the paint wears off the one I got.
You've heard of King Midas? Well, he was a candidate for the poorhouse compared with Joey Harper. You wouldn't believe what he managed to accomplish in the next 3 hours. You wouldn't believe it unless I gave you my word for it, and I was there with him when it happened.
116-cylinder limousine, I'll pay for it in cash.
Yes, sir.
One ermine wrap from a girlfriend, and I'll pay for it in cash.
Yes, sir.
This Delco looks nice. I'll take 4, and don't forget the shoes, the shirts, the socks, and the suits. I want the most expensive money can buy. Oh, yeah, and throw in those garters over there. You know, the ones with the diamond buckles? And stick my initials on everything, brother, just the way I like. If you got something to sell, then bring it up. I'll buy anything and everything just as long as it isn't cheap, and I'll pay for it in cash.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, Joey.
Mr. Pickering.
I hope you don't mind my waiting here in your room. I was wondering how you made out.
Oh, I'm doing fine. I just bought that 4-story private house. You know, the one that faces Fifth Avenue? And I told him to throw in the doorman for luck.
How does it feel to have all that money?
Oh, it feels like being on a merry-go-round.
You haven't got tired of it yet?
Tired of it? You mean there are people who get tired of money?
I was merely asking.
Brother, I'll never get tired of it.
Well, enjoy yourself, Joey. I presume you have everything you want.
Just about, except my girl. But when her mother hears about this doll... Oh, yeah, but that reminds me, I'm running short.
I thought you might.
I don't like to be a hog about this, Mr. Pickering, but you told me it was only a drop in the bucket.
Quite so.
And $500,000 isn't nearly enough for what I want to buy.
I guessed as much, so I took the liberty of bringing more.
You mean... inside the suitcase?
Yes, Joey. There's $10 million in here.
$10 million?
You think it might last for the rest of the week? However, it doesn't matter. There's really no limit to what you can spend. Oh, Joey, the money is mostly in $1,000 bills.
So I noticed.
And just in case you've been having trouble changing bills of that denomination, I've added a few $100,000 in fives and tens. I hope you don't mind.
$10 million. Holy smokes.
Enjoy it, Joey. And remember that the bucket hasn't even been touched.
What a boat, Joey. And what a car. That's the slickest job I ever saw.
Come around on Sunday, Barry, and I'll have my chauffeur take you for a spin around the park.
Oh, Joey, darling, I think it's wonderful.
wonderful. Mother just can't wait until we get married.
Well, she'll just have to wait. Tell her to take it easy, and maybe I'll even invite her to the wedding.
Two Rembrandts and one Da Vinci. Is there anything else you'd like to buy, sir?
Why, sure. There must be something else. There must be.
Yes, Joey had bought everything he could think of, and he still had millions left. He had all the money in the world, but he didn't have all the time in the world in which to spend it. Then something peculiar started to happen in Joey's mind. The last shopping spree he'd had wasn't half as much fun as the first. There didn't seem to be anything left for him to buy. He had everything a man could ask for, yet somehow he wasn't happy. And he wondered why.
Joey.
Oh, hello, Mr. Pickering.
I thought I'd come up and see you again once more.
Oh, now, look, Mr. Pickering, I don't need any more money. Honestly, I don't. Look, I'm having a tough enough time right now spending what you gave me, so will you take it easy for a while, please?
What's the matter, Joey? You sound unhappy. You have everything you want, everything you've ever wished for. Isn't that enough?
Well, it should be.
But it isn't. I know. I came to that conclusion myself. You see, Joey, you have nothing to look forward to, nothing to work for. When things come as easily as they've come to you, they lose their value. They become cheap, Joey, even though they're worth a fortune.
Is that what happened to you, Mr. Pickering?
Yeah, my fate was even worse. All my life I'd lived to achieve one goal, and then when I thought I'd accomplished an artistic triumph, I found that I'd failed. But one day I'll try again, Joey. Oh, yes, one day I'll try again.
Try what?
To make the perfect $1,000 bill.
You made that money you gave me yourself?
I am a printer, Joey, and for 20 years I've printed nothing but handbills and dinner menus. But I also happen to be a genius, and I was going to prove it. My goal was to make money so perfect in every detail that the right thing would look like a counterfeit.
Oh. Oh. You didn't make enough of it, though. You didn't.
Now, just a minute, Joey.
No.
Remember this. I didn't make that money to cheat the government. Oh, no. I never spent a cent of it. To me, it was an artistic goal, no more, no less. I am not a counterfeiter, Joey. I am an artist. Here, Joey, what are you doing?
I'm calling the police.
Don't bother. They're right outside your door. They followed me here.
You got me into this, Mr. Pickering. You got me into this. You got to get me out.
Joey, you're getting too excited.
I didn't know that dough was bad. You gave it to me. You told me it was a reward, Mr. Pickering.
And so it was, a generous reward.
Open up in the name of the law.
No, they aren't going to take me. Stay out. Stay out of
you
here.
You can't escape, Joey. There's nothing you can do. And your time is running short.
You and your money. Why'd you keep out of my life? Who wants your money? Who wants it? Who wants it?
Duty.
Why, it's the district attorney himself.
$5 million. He passed $5 million in counterfeit money.
And we'll give him a year in jail for every nickel.
No.
Oh, he told his chauffeur to take me for a ride. Now he'll take a little ride for himself.
Keep away from me. Keep away from me, all of you.
My mother was right. Joey Harvey, you've disgraced me.
Lois, you gotta listen, Lois. I wouldn't hurt you, Lois. Lois, honest, I wouldn't.
500 years in jail.
In solitary confinement.
And I get the girl.
No.
500 years in jail.
For hard labor.
And I get the girl.
No, don't touch me, Lois. Lois, you've gotta listen.
Oh, listen. That's my fault. You've got to listen.
It's all right, Joey. I know. We all know, Joey. Joey, it's all right.
What?
Joey. Joey, darling.
Lois? Where are we?
You're in a hospital, Joey. You've been delirious ever since you started to come out of the ether.
Ether?
Don't you remember? That old man you tried to save downtown, you pushed him out of the way and the bus hit you.
The bus hit me?
But the doctor said you'd be all right. Oh, Joey, I was so frightened, so scared I'd lose you.
Then it was all in my mind? Just in my mind?
It talked so much and said such funny things. The doctor told me that often happens to patients like you. Joey?
Well?
Haven't you noticed the flowers?
Yeah. The flowers.
Mother sent them.
What?
Joey, you're a hero. You've saved somebody's life. You're going to be in the papers tomorrow and everything. But best of all, Mother thinks you're wonderful. And she's planning the wedding just as soon as you're well. Oh, I don't care if we have to struggle a while, because I know you'll make good if we work hard together.
Mr. Pickering said you gotta have something to look forward to and work for to be happy.
Mr. Pickering? Well, who's he?
Just the guy I met out of the ether. Lois, pinch me.
Pinch you? What for?
I just want to make sure I'm still not under the ether.
And that's the story of Joey Harper as recorded by the clock. Well, it worked out pretty well, all things considered. The moral? Well, yes, I suppose there is a moral to this story, but I'd prefer to leave it up to you. Sleep on it tonight. Give me your answer in the morning. I'll be at your bedside, but I'll make sure to ring before I drop in. And now it's time to leave you once again. It's been very pleasant for me. I hope it's been enjoyable for you.
This program is written by Lawrence Klee, and you've heard Hart McGuire as the clock. As Joey, Rodney Jacobs. As Mr. Pickering, Owen Ainley. Others were Carly Neville, John Bonney, Ken Hannah. The clock is directed by John Saul, a Grace Gibson radio production.
Another 5-minute mystery.
Slade.
Oh, yeah, Sheriff. What can he do for you?
Seems there's been some excitement out at the X-Bar Dude Ranch. One of them dude vacations at Des Akoya.
Okay, Sheriff. I'll meet you out there in about a half an hour.
Right.
Well, here's the sheriff now. Hiya, Sheriff.
Howdy, Dan. Having some trouble out here?
Yeah, I reckon it's not going to be any too good for my business either. One of the guests up and got herself killed.
Where's the body, Dan?
Oh, right in the house here. Fella named Vaughn Calder. That's her husband. He's inside with her. Oh. Hey, it's Hardy, Mr. Calder. It's Sheriff Slade in the corner.
How do you do, gentlemen?
Hate to bother you like this, Mr. Calder. We'll just have to ask a couple of questions.
Go right ahead, Sheriff. I'm rather broken up, but I'll try to be of some help.
Vaughn, I just heard. I'm so terribly sorry. But maybe it's for the... Oh, I didn't know that.
That's all right, Nora. This is Sheriff Slade in the coroner. This is Nora Bradley, gentlemen.
Any relation to you, Mr. Calder?
Why, no, we're going to be married, that's all.
Then I reckon you and your wife weren't hitting it off so well.
There's no use my hiding anything. We weren't hitting it off. She'd known about Nora and me for some time now. I'd asked her a dozen times for a divorce. She wouldn't give it to me. But I wouldn't have had anything like this happen. I didn't hate her.
How did she die, Mr. Calder?
She was bitten by a rattlesnake. You can see the little hole in her arm.
Will you take a look at the body, coroner?
Sure.
Go on, Mr. Calder.
We were out riding this morning. We'd gotten off the horses to rest for a while. I had my back turned to her for a few moments as I tied the horses to a tree. I heard her scream. I turned around, and there was a large rattlesnake a few feet away from her, poised to strike. I saw the fangs shoot out from its mouth and plunge into her arm. It was horrible.
Then what happened?
Well, we were only 10 minutes from the ranch. I got her back here as fast as I could. She was dead when I arrived.
What's your report, Garner?
Everything's as he says, Sheriff. Small puncture in the left forearm accompanied by large swelling of the surrounding tissue. She died of rattlesnake poison, all right.
But not by a rattlesnake.
I don't get you, Sheriff.
You've had a murder on your ranch. Vaughn Calder murdered his wife.
Have you found the clues that led the sheriff to accuse Von Calder of murder? The solution in a moment, but first...
Men, Frank Crummett is here with me to say a word about Roy Tan cigars. Frank Crummett.
I'm really a fan for Roy Tan, and the reason is Roy Tan has more long filler Havana tobacco, and yet it's a 5-cent cigar. Man to man, smoke Roy Tan.
And now, back to our story.
What are you trying to do? The coroner just told you she died of rattlesnake poison.
There's no doubt about that, Calder. But it weren't administered by a rattlesnake. You injected poisonous venom into your wife's arm with a hypodermic needle, then watched her die a slow, painful death. And like most people, you don't know much about snakes, Calder. That evil-looking thing that the snake shoots from its mouth is not a fang. That's just the tongue. Every snake has that, poisonous or non-poisonous. But the real fangs, and I said fangs, plural, are two long teeth in the forward part of the mouth, which are never seen. If she'd been bitten by a real rattler, she'd have two punctures instead of one.
The next show is from the Hall of Fantasy for April the 13th of 1953. It's called Demon of the Night. Actually, and this isn't really much of a spoiler, because it becomes evident almost immediately, it really should be called Werewolf of the Night. There are several incarnations of this program, all run by the same person, Richard Thorne, who directed and wrote most of the scripts and quite often starred in them as well. The first incarnation, and this episode is not from the first incarnation, began at radio station KALL in Salt Lake City, Utah. It ran for 26 shows with uncertain air dates. Most of those shows, though, were classic murder mysteries, which culminated in the villain getting his due. I'm told that there are only 6 shows from this series that are known to exist. The next incarnation featured stories involving struggles with the supernatural, and usually man was the loser. It consisted of 122 shows airing on WGN. Then in 1953, the Hall of Fantasy went nationwide on the Mutual Network as a regular series of 39 shows. This is one of those.
And now for our story. An original tale of fantasy by Richard Thorne entitled The Demon of the Night. Two ways of looking at it. Either one believes that they died accidentally from natural causes, or else we have to admit that there was something in the darkness waiting for them, waiting for anyone who'd be unsuspecting enough to walk alone at night. I leave it up to you. Decide for yourself whether Raphael Sebastian was a maniacal killer, whether he was what so many people have called him, a creature of the darkness, spawned in the mind of evil in the darkness of night, running on all fours to leap upon his unsuspecting victim. He came to our town on the midnight train. Why I happened to be there at the station, I attribute to restlessness. Sheriff Craig was there, too. Who's that?
Ken Parker, Sheriff.
What are you doing down here?
I couldn't sleep.
She's right on time.
Yeah.
Why did she come down here?
I don't know. Figured I might as well walk down to the station and see who might be getting off the midnight train.
Then you knew he was coming tonight.
Who was coming?
Sebastian.
You mean the man who bought the old Claymore place?
That's right.
No, I didn't. I'm kind of anxious to see you. It's funny the way he bought the place, wasn't it?
Yeah. Calling up at night when the real estate office was shut down. Having old Matt Ryerson describe the place to him over the phone. Then mail him a check. I'm kind of anxious to see how he looks.
Now, here's the train.
Right on time.
Someone's getting off.
That must be him.
He's looking around.
I'm pleased to meet you.
How do you do?
Did you come down here to see me?
Yes and no.
What do you mean by that?
I was kind of interested in you. I mean, the way you bought the old Claymore place and everything. I wanted to see the man who bought it over the telephone. Besides, I couldn't sleep.
Who told you I was coming?
Old Matt Ryerson, the real estate agent.
And you, Mr. Parker, why did you come down?
I don't know, Mr. Sebastian. I guess I couldn't sleep either.
Well, it's rather late. You should not... Oh, here he comes. I must talk to him about being late. It's been very pleasant meeting you, gentlemen. I hope that we may meet again quite soon.
Thank you, Mr. Sebastian. I imagine we'll be seeing you around.
I imagine you will, Sheriff. Good night.
Good night. I get a funny feeling about that man, Ken.
How do you mean?
I can't explain it. His eyes look sort of funny. And his hands. Did you notice his hands?
Yes, I did.
Notice how they were just covered with hair? Thick and furry, just like an animal.
I was a little surprised that the sheriff had fastened upon the same things I had. There was only one light on the deserted station platform, but Raphael Sebastian had stopped directly beneath it while he waited for his car. There was something strange about his eyes. But the thing which had sent an unaccountable tremor of fear through me was his hands. They were small hands, graceful and well-formed. They were covered with a thick coating of hair, and as Craig had said, they did remind one of the fur of an animal. Perhaps I should mention that I owned the paper in this small town we live in. It was always news to us to note the departures and arrivals in the town. So I knew that Saturday, when the Gazette came out, it would have an item about Sebastian's arrival. Both Sheriff Craig and I lived in the outskirts of the town. So I drove him back to his house and stopped in for a cup of coffee.
Now, I hope you don't mind it being a little strong.
That's the way I like it, Sheriff.
Sue always makes it so weak I can't stand to drink this stuff. Tastes like dirty dishwater.
Cream and sugar? No, I like it black.
Appreciate the flavor, huh?
So do I.
Paper getting along all right?
Mm-hmm.
You've been doing a good job since your father died, Ken. I didn't... Listen. Yeah, I hear it.
Must be a dog.
Ain't no dog. No dog ever howls like that.
And what is it?
Haven't been any of those critters anywhere near here in a long time.
You mean that's a wolf?
That's what it is. Shot a lot of them when I was young.
Probably out looking for food.
Maybe.
There it is again.
And it gives you the creeps, don't it?
A little.
Sounds like a big one. Maybe we'd better go out.
What was that?
I don't know. It sounded like a window breaking. Isn't any mistake in that sound? That was a scream. Come on!
Right. The only other house out here is Widow Brady's.
Scream must have come from there, then. Don't see any lights on.
Definitely came from our house. I don't know it.
Miss Brady! Miss Brady!
Maybe the door is unlocked.
No, she always leaves it locked.
Miss
Jason! Riley! Listen, like an animal. Come on. We're going to break this door open. You ready?
Yeah.
All right. Then together. Do it again. She's sleeping on the first floor bedroom.
Just follow me.
This is ready.
The light's right here. Mrs. Brady. Something. Some animal must have been in here. Look at her. It's... What a horrible way to die.
I had stopped at Sheriff Craig's house for a late cup of coffee. We'd just returned from the station in our first meeting with Raphael Sebastian. A scream had echoed in the night. We raced outside to see what was wrong. What we found... death. That wolf again.
You think that wolf killed Mrs. Brady?
That's what it looks like, doesn't it? What are you going to do?
That animal's got to be killed.
That's what I'm going to do. Craig went out by himself that night in an attempt to track the animal. But though the tracks were quite clear outside the broken window, it was impossible to follow them. By morning, a light rain had sprung up, and all traces of the tracks disappeared. I was at the paper the following day, getting everything ready to go to press.
Ken. Ken!
Oh, Alice, I'm sorry, darling. I didn't see you come in.
I'm beginning to feel jealous of that typewriter. What are you writing now?
Well, the story of what happened last night.
It's already all over the town.
Yes, I know. But they'll read about it just the same.
Matt Ryerson told me that an animal had killed Mrs. Brady.
That's right.
He said something about a big wolf. Is that true?
As far as Craig and I know.
Well, they better catch the animal and kill it, Ken. The town's getting panicky.
Well, Craig was going to trail it, but when the rain came this morning, there wasn't any trail to follow.
Oh, it's not raining now.
Don't you see, Alice? The rain washed the tracks away.
You two talking over your marriage plan?
No, Sheriff. We were talking about what happened last night.
I thought you might be different. The whole town's talking about that.
Anything new, Sheriff?
Not a thing. Town's getting all head up about it. I don't like it.
Anything I can do for you, Sheriff?
Hey, Ken, I'm going out to see that Sebastian fella. Want to come along?
Of course.
Sebastian?
Came in last night on midnight train.
What are you going out to see him for?
Just to see him, that's all.
Sheriff Craig and I went out to his car, got in and drove out to the old Glaymore mansion. It was a few miles out of town, well back from the highway. We turned into the gravel road that led to the house. It'll be pretty nice to see this old place fixed up. Certainly gone to ruin since Claymore died.
It will be nice to see it fixed up, but I...
But what?
Yeah, I don't know. This killing's got me down.
Don't worry, Craig. You'll get through it.
I hope so.
Well, we're here.
Now, let's go.
All right. All that rain this morning has certainly turned into a nice day.
Kind of a day I like to go fishing.
Yeah, me too.
I guess that servant of his must have come out early to get the house in order. He was the knock again.
Good afternoon, Sheriff.
Afternoon, Mr. Sebastian.
Are you here on business?
A little.
I want you to come in then.
Thanks.
You certainly cleaned it up in here.
My servant Carlos was here for some time. Sit down if you will, huh? Now, what can I do for you?
Last night, when you were driving out here, did you see or hear anything?
I don't understand. Like a wolf. A wolf.
That's right.
No, I didn't. Why do you ask?
We had a killing in town last night.
You mean someone was murdered?
Yes. By a wolf. At least that's what we think it is.
What happened? Was someone out walking?
No, the wolf broke through a window to enter the house.
Oh, that sounds impossible to believe.
Yeah, I know. I just want to warn you, living way out here the way you do, to make sure you have plenty of protection.
Oh, do not worry, Sheriff. I am able to protect myself. Did the animal leave any trail?
Yes, he did.
Yeah, but I couldn't follow it in the dark. And when it was light enough to see, a storm started and washed out the tracks.
Oh, that's too bad.
Well, you keep your eyes open, Mr. Sebastian.
I will, Sheriff.
Come on, Ken, let's go.
We went outside, got into the car, and started back to town. We'd driven for about 5 minutes before I realized that something was different about Sebastian. I think Sheriff Craig realized it at the same time. Sheriff?
What?
I just thought of something.
So did I.
You noticed his hands?
Yeah. That's what I was thinking, too.
There was no hair on them at all. I thought we must have been mistaken the night before, but then I wasn't so sure. Both Sheriff Craig and I had seen his hands the night before. Both of us couldn't be mistaken. We didn't have much time for further speculation, however. I had to get back to the paper. I was behind in my work, and I had to make up for lost time. About 8 o'clock that evening, Alice came down to help me. We worked steadily until almost 11.
Walker?
Yeah? What time is it?
Oh, almost 11.
Well, I'd better get you home. Finish up in the morning.
Well, I can go home alone if you want to stay here, Ken.
No, Alice, I don't want you out in the streets now. Not if there's any chance of that animal returning. Let's go.
I've never seen the town look so deserted at 11 o'clock.
You're all afraid.
Oh, look, there's Sheriff Craig.
Sheriff.
Hello, Ken.
I see you're wearing two guns here.
That's right. Not going to take any chances. You walking Alice home, Ken?
Yes.
Well, I might as well go along with you. Everybody must be staying inside.
No, not everybody, Sheriff. Look up there. Isn't that Matt Ryerson?
I can't see too well. We need more streetlights in this town.
Yes, I heard it.
I don't like this.
There's an animal up there. It's tearing him to pieces.
No. No, it's running away now.
Missed him, doggone it.
Matt, are you all right?
A wolf with a human face.
He's dead.
Did you hear what he said, Ken? He said a wolf with a human face.
Sheriff Craig and I were walking out of his home. It was after 11. The streets were deserted and dark. Old Matt Ryerson lay on the ground where he had fallen after the attack. Before our eyes, he died.
Did you hear what he said, Ken? He said a wolf with a human face.
I heard what he said.
That thing out there in the darkness, whatever it is, it's got to be killed.
What do you mean, Sheriff? Whatever it is.
Just what I said.
You think it's something besides a wolf?
Well, I don't know for sure.
What are we going to do with him?
There's nothing much we can do. Isn't a pretty sight, is it? I guess I'll call Simmons. Then we'll drop you off, Alice.
And then what?
You'll come along, Ken. Then you and I will follow the trail of that killer.
Good thing that it did rain. Ground's pretty soft. Makes the trail easier to follow.
We've been out for almost 3 hours.
I know. I wonder if that critter knows what's following it.
Aren't you endowing it with the faculty of reason?
Maybe.
No animal is capable of reasoning.
That's where you're making a mistake. All animals can reason a little, and I know one that can reason a lot.
There's only one animal. You mean a man.
That's right, a man. A man that can take on the form of a wolf.
That's not possible.
You should listen to my wife talk. She can tell you some stories that will make the hair on the back of your neck stand up.
A man that assumes the form of a wolf, that's only legend, folk belief.
You figure it your way. I'll figure it mine. That critter's getting closer to us.
You sure?
Of course I am. We aren't tracking it anymore. It's tracking us.
Maybe you've been wondering why I'm carrying two guns tonight.
Well, here, one of them is for you. Thanks. We better stop.
You, notice which way we've been traveling?
North.
That's right. And what lies north of the town?
Nothing, except the old Claymore place.
That's where we've been heading. We aren't more than a half a mile away from it.
You're really serious in believing we're dealing with a werewolf. Dead serious. Listen. I heard something. Keep your eyes open. I can't see anything.
Don't talk. Just shoot. Just look.
Out.
There it is.
I see it.
Yeah. We might as well stop. No sense shooting at the shadows. It's too far away by now. Did you notice which way we're going?
North.
Yeah, just about a half a mile towards the old Claymore place. You and me, we're going there, too. We're going to pay Mr. Sebastian a visit.
Shine your light again.
Yeah, that's right. There's the blood spot again. You got any doubts now where the trail ends? It's only 25 feet away from us.
Look, the paw prints end here.
That's right. And you see the bare footprints of a man. Now, do you believe me?
I guess so.
Now, when we get inside, you let me do most of the talking.
All right.
Here's a knocker.
Right.
I wonder who'll answer the door, Sebastian or his servant.
We don't have long to find out. I think someone's coming. Yes? Oh, it's you, Sheriff Craig. Hey, Mr. Parker, what can I do for you, huh?
We'd like to come in and talk a spell.
Well, it's rather late.
What I have to say won't keep.
Well, then, come in.
How come your servant didn't open the door?
Oh, why, he left my employ.
I guess I must have missed him when he took the train.
Yes, you must have. We can talk here.
I see you have a bandage on your hand. Did you hurt it some way?
I caught it. Now, what do you want to talk to me about?
About two killings. And I think maybe a third.
What do you mean?
The old woman that was killed last night, Widow Brady, you didn't know her. And Matt Ryerson, he was killed tonight. And your servant, when did he die?
You're insane.
No, we're not, Mr. Sebastian. First time I looked at your hands, I knew there was something wrong about you. They're covered with hair, just like the hair of a wolf. They're only covered at night, not in the daytime.
You don't know what you're talking about.
And you didn't cut your hands, Sebastian. We shot you when you tried to attack us tonight.
You have no proof, Craig. You're accusing me of being a shapeshifter, a werewolf. You don't expect people to believe you, do you?
I don't care what they believe. We know what you are. We're going to see that you can't kill anyone else.
You don't think that you can stop me, do you, Craig?
Look at his hands, Sheriff. They're changing.
Yes, look at me, Craig. Wait, we shall see who you are. We'll tell.
Use your gun and don't leave.
Are you sure?
I wouldn't be making a mistake about that.
No. Sebastian is dead. I'll never forget what I saw. Right before our eyes, he changed. First into an animal, and then as he was dying, back into a man.
You'd better forget it if you know what's wise. People aren't going to believe you now that he's dead. If he was alive and the murders went on, and then they'd believe you. But not now. Officially, I killed Sebastian in the line of duty for the murder of three people. Unofficially, and you and I know the truth, I killed a wolf who was the demon of the night.
The Murder Hole by Anonymous. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Taryn Maximilian Defoe. The Murder Hole by Anonymous. About 300 years ago, on the estate of Lord Cathalus, between Ayrshire and Galloway, lay a great moor, unrelieved by any trees or vegetation. It was rumored that unwary travelers had been intercepted and murdered there, and that no investigation ever revealed what had happened to them. People living in a nearby hamlet believed that in the dead of night they sometimes heard a sudden cry of anguish, and a shepherd who had lost his way once declared that he had seen three mysterious figures struggling together until one of them, with a frightful scream, sank suddenly into the earth. So terrifying was this place that at last no one remained there, except one old woman and her two sons, who were too poor to flee, as their neighbors had done. Travelers occasionally begged a night's lodging at their cottage, rather than continue their journey across the moor in darkness, and even by day, no one traveled that way, except in companies of at least two or three people. One stormy November night, a peddler boy was overtaken by darkness on the moor. Terrified by the solitude, he repeated to himself the promises of Scripture, and so struggled toward the old cottage, which he had visited the year before, in a large company of travelers, and where he felt assured of a welcome. Its light guided him from afar, and he knocked at the door, but at first received no answer. He then peered through a window, and saw that the occupants were all at their accustomed occupations. The old woman was scrubbing the floor, and strewing it with sand. Her two sons seemed to be thrusting something large and heavy into a great chest, which they then hastily locked. There was an air of haste about all of this which puzzled the waiting boy outside. He tapped lightly on the window, and they all started up with consternation on their faces, and one of the men suddenly darted out at the door, seized the boy roughly by the shoulder, and dragged him inside. He said, trying to laugh, "I'm only the poor peddler who visited you last year." "Are you alone?" cried the old woman in a harsh, deep voice. "Alone here, and alone in the whole world," replied the boy sadly. "Then you are welcome," said one of the men with a sneer. Their words filled the boy with alarm, and the confusion and desolation of the formerly neat and orderly cottage seemed to show signs of recent violence. The curtains had been torn down from the bed to which he was shown, and though he begged for a light to burn until he fell asleep, his terror kept him long awake. In the middle of the night, he was awakened by a single cry of distress. He sat up and listened, but it was not repeated. And he would have lain down to sleep again, but suddenly his eye fell on a stream of blood, slowly trickling under the door of his room. In terror, he sprang to the door, and through a chink he saw that the victim outside was only a goat. But just then he overheard the voices of the two men, and their words transfixed him with horror. "I wish all the throats we cut were as easy," said one. "Did you ever hear such a noise as the old gentleman made last night?" "Ah, the murder hole's the thing for me," said the other. "One plunge and the fellow's dead, and buried in a moment." "How do you mean to dispatch the lad in there?" asked the old woman in a harsh whisper, and one of the men silently drew his bloody knife across his throat to answer. The terrified boy crept to his window and managed to let himself down without a sound, but as he stood, wondering which way to turn, a dreadful cry rang out. "The boy has escaped! Let loose the bloodhound!" He ran for his life, blindly, but all too soon he heard the dreadful baying of the hound and the voices of the men in pursuit. Suddenly he stumbled and fell on a heap of rough stones which cut him in every limb, so that his blood poured over the stones. He staggered to his feet and ran on. The hound was so near that he could almost feel its breath on his back. But suddenly it smelled the blood on the stones, and thinking the chase at an end, it lay down and refused to go farther after the same scent. The boy fled on and on till morning, and when at last he reached a village, his pitiable state and his fearful story roused such wrath that three gibbets were at once set upon the moor, and before night the three villains had been captured and had confessed their guilt. The bones of their victims were later discovered, and with great difficulty brought up from the dreadful hole with its narrow aperture into which they had been thrust. End of The Murder Hole Recorded by Taryn Maximilian Defoe in Los Angeles, California. September 23rd, 2010.
We got a break. But we'll be back real soon with some science fiction. I hope you like science fiction. I sure do. Despite what I just said, you know, where I asked you if you like science fiction and told you how much I did, and thereby kind of leading you to expect that the next presentation would be science fiction, this next show, an episode of the CBS Radio Workshop from February the 6th of 1956, is more of a light fantasy. The CBS Radio Workshop was a really kind of an interesting program that debuted on CBS on January the 27th of 1956 and would run until September 22nd of 1957. Actually, it was a revival of an earlier program, Columbia Workshop, which was broadcast by CBS from 1936 to 1943. The CBS Radio Workshop used some of the same authors and directors employed in the earlier series and has been considered by many to be American Network Radio's last serious attempt to hold on to perhaps recapture some of the demographics that they lost to television in the post-World War II era. They did a little bit of everything there. They did documentaries, they did science fiction. The first program that they did was a two-part adaptation of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, which was introduced and narrated by Huxley. I gotta play that one. I've got it. The music for the series was composed by Bernard Herrmann and Jerry Goldsmith. Writers whose work were adapted for the series included Bob Heinlein, Sinclair Lewis, H.L. Mencken, Edgar Allan Poe, Frederick Pohl, James Thurber, Mark Twain, James Wolfe. This really was a fine effort, and I hope you enjoyed tonight's outing. I certainly did when I first heard it.
Being an old research man myself with an advertising agency named Blair, Thomas & Cain, I once looked up the source of that old chestnut about coming events casting their shadows before. It's from a rather obscure poem called Lochiel's Warning by an English poet named Thomas Campbell. Well, I've used the quotation many times, but actually you never know what shadow is foretelling what event. I know I didn't have the slightest inkling that I was in for the biggest event in my life when Dr. Johnson said to me,
"Well, as a matter of fact, since midnight, every baby that's been born in the hospital has been a boy."
The CBS Radio Workshop. Dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Today, the big event, a fantasy for radio by Gloria Dapper and Draper Lewis. A fantasy about the law of averages and the day the law of averages ran out.
It may seem like ancient history going over that day now, but everyone else has had a chance to tell what happened to them, so why shouldn't I? I was in the waiting room of the maternity ward of a hospital when it all started. There were four or five other guys sweating it out with me. We'd been there most of the night. It was close to 1:30 in the morning. But it wasn't quiet like it usually is at that time in a hospital. Mr. Blair, my boss, had arrived around 10 to keep me company. At least that was his excuse for bending my ear for three solid hours. I kept saying to him, look, Mr. Blair, you don't have to bother waiting with me. It may be hours before anything happens.
It's my pleasure, Danny, my complete pleasure. Now, just relax. Old E.C. Blair is quarterbacking this play. There's no reason in the world why we can't improve each shining hour with a little business for Blair, Thomas, and Cain.
Well, Mr. Blair, I told you my dad wouldn't be interested in that kind of a deal.
If you're interested, Danny, he'll be interested.
Well, you don't know him the way I do. He never wants to... Oh, just a minute, Mr. Blair.
No, I'm sorry, Mr. No. Not yet.
Mr. Vance?
Yeah, I'm Vance.
It's the boy, Mr. Vance. You just follow me.
Another boy? Well, what are you going to do? So maybe we'll end up with a basketball team.
Calling Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson, please.
Oh, I wonder what all this excitement's about anyway. I wish Adele were here.
Adele?
Maggie's mother. She was due in from Europe tonight on the Washington. She said she'd come straight to the hospital.
Oh, well, maybe she was held up going through customs or getting a cab from the pier. Danny, look. You don't want to spend the rest of your life in research. You're cut out for bigger things, boy. There's no reason why you couldn't end up being captain of the team. But you've got to get in there and fight. You can't just sit around waiting for Lady Luck to hand you the ball. You make your own luck, boy. You grab that ball and run. Now, that's all I'm asking you to do.
Well, I don't know how I could explain it to him.
Oh, well, there's nothing to explain. Just ask your dad to get on the phone with that chain of drugstores he's got and tell him to duck every other headache pill except Banish. Make sure Banish is right there where everyone can see it and buy it. Get the clerks to push him a little. Just a little push, that's all.
Now, what about the new ad campaign on Banish?
We'll use that, too. But you need a little something extra riding for you if you want things your way, my boy. If your dad gets Banish started up the field, no one can stop us. Nobody has to wait for the brakes if he's smart, my boy. And you're smart, Danny.
Boy, for you, Miss Marin, but the nurse will be out in a minute to take you in to your wife.
Danny?
Any news yet, Doctor?
Not yet. Might as well go home and get some sleep. I could use some myself. Come on, I'll walk you down the hall.
Mr. Blair?
Coming, Danny boy.
Maggie's okay, isn't she, Doctor?
She's fine.
Be nice if it's a girl. We sort of planned on a little girl.
You better keep your fingers crossed. You see.
You mean you think it's going to be a boy?
Well, as a matter of fact, since midnight, every baby that's been born in the hospital has been a boy.
Calling Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson, please.
Hospital on the Lexington Avenue side. Mr. Blair hailed a cab and offered to drop me off. But just then a second cab pulled over to the curb and I told him I'd take my own since I was going over to the west side and he lived east on Sutton Place. As the cab pulled out into the early morning traffic, I kept thinking about what Mr. Blair had told me, the call he wanted me to make to Dad in the morning. And especially I kept thinking about Maggie and the baby and how much easier it would be if we had a little extra dough coming in. I didn't even hear the driver when he said...
Funny thing about the traffic tonight. It's all been going the same direction.
Was it really right to try to twist chance your way? And what would happen if you did?
It's all going west, too. Lucky thing you live on the west side.
Now what?
It's a lucky thing you live on the west side. The traffic's all been going west since midnight.
Anything strange about that?
No. It's all been going downtown, too. Every place except near Pier 32. Oh, what a mess that is.
Pier 32? That's where the Washington docks.
Brother, what a mess. You might even call it a riot.
Get me over there, fast.
Hey, mister, if I was you, I'd stay in a cab. You'll never get on a pier through that spot.
Wait for me here.
You heard what I said. No one else is allowed on the pier. Now just keep moving and no one will get hurt.
Officer, please, I've got to get on the pier. There's a member of my family getting off the Washington.
I don't care if it's Marilyn Monroe. No one's allowed out on the pier. It ain't safe the way it is now.
Well, what's happened? What's going on out there?
Look for yourself. There hasn't been a passenger off that liner yet that hasn't had the baggage under the letter R.
Well, that's ridiculous. That's impossible.
Ridiculous or impossible, that's the way it is. 1,800 passengers getting off that liner and all the names starting with the letter R. Figure it out for yourself, mister.
I went home, made a pot of coffee, and sat down to wait. 2 hours later, the front doorbell rang. I opened the door, and Adele said to me,
"The next time I marry a man named Robertson, please drag me away from the altar. Oh, where's my bedroom? I'm dead."
Next morning, Adele and I decided that everything that had happened the night before, the babies, the traffic, the mess at the pier, everything had just been one of those freak accidents. Well, what else could it be? I had done a lot of thinking about more important things. I decided that maybe E.C. Blair was right after all. Why should I spend the rest of my life in research? It wasn't much fun being a permanent little fish in a big pond. I've been waiting too long for Lady Luck to toss a little extra loot my way. And now for the first time, I had the chance to make things work the way I wanted them. I went into the living room and picked up the phone.
Long distance?
I want to make a person-to-person call to Mr. John Nolan, Sunshine Drug Corporation, Chicago. The number is Temple 34573. Until I left the apartment that I started to find out what was really going on. At first, it just seemed like one coincidence after another. I stopped by the newsstand, and Pete said to me,
"You're going to have to take another paper this morning, Mr. Nolan. I've been all sold out of the Times since 7:30.
And the bus driver was yelling,
No, I can't change another five. Aren't they making anything except $5 bills? Now stop it, will you? Stop it."
But that was just the beginning. When we pulled into Madison and 53rd, all the passengers got off at the same stop, all of them. They all went into the same building where I work. They all got on the same elevator.
All right, don't push. Floors, please.
And they all got out at the same floor, my floor.
I have an appointment with Mr. Elmore.
I could talk to you.
Come on, look. We're all going to have to get in line or something. Blair Thomas and Kane, reception.
No, Mr. Thomas. I'm sorry. I'm trying.
I'm sorry, miss, but I'm already 10 minutes late for my appointment. Would you please
see it? Please, I only have one pair of hands. If you'll just be quiet and give me a chance.
What? Oh, no, I wasn't talking to you, Mr. Thomas. No, sir. Okay, everyone, now quiet down and let's take it one at a time. One at a time.
Good morning, Mr.
Morning, Elaine. Some madhouse out there.
It's getting worse all the time.
You know, everything has gone real goofy this morning. Have you noticed anything strange going on besides the riot outside?
Oh, I certainly have. The teletypes are coming in by the bushel. Hope we have a profit-sharing bonus this Christmas.
Huh? What do you mean?
Our sales. They're fantastic in 10 major cities. Every Blair, Thomas, and Kane product is suddenly booming. I've been around long enough to see a product catch fire, but 32 of them. Never.
Well, let me see those teletypes. Oh, this is incredible. And Banish is right in there with him.
Banish is leading the field, as Mr. Blair would put it. Looks like our lucky day, huh?
Well, I'm not so sure it's luck. What else is world-shaking?
Call Bill Paris about lunch today.
I'll do that right away.
A funny thing happened out in Jackson Heights this morning. Every dog on our block bit the poor mailman. He was a wreck.
Hastings and Cole, good morning.
Bill Paris, please. Yeah, well, remind me to tell you what happened on our bus.
Hello?
Bill, Danny Nolan.
Oh, yeah, Danny. Look, I can't make lunch today. I'll be lucky if I ever get anything to eat again.
Oh, things jumping at your place, too? Aren't those teletypes the kind you have daydreams about?
Nightmares, you mean? You've got a funny sense of humor today.
What do you mean?
I mean, we're practically wiped out. If this trend doesn't reverse itself in an hour, we'll have to throw in the towel.
Well, Bill, I don't get it.
Hey, what sort of practices are you guys using over at your shop? Everything you're handling is turning to gold. The rest of Madison Avenue is getting ready to move to the Bowery.
You mean our products are the only ones that are moving?
Well, if you call Grease Lightning moving, not a recorded sale in the country for anything except Blair products today. Danny, we've been friends for a long time. You sure there isn't anything under the counter going on over there?
Bill, look, I'll call you back.
If I'm still here. If not, try Welfare Island.
Mr. Blair has just called a special conference. You want it right now in the lion's den.
Okay, men. Let's get in unison here. Well, I suppose you've noticed the teletypes. I'd say that this is a 14-chart day for Blair, Thomas, and Kane. Men have brought you in here to see that this roller coaster stays on the track.
But it doesn't make sense, Mr. Blair. I've been talking to a friend of mine over at Hastings and Cole. They're worried.
Worried? They're frantic. Walker, Auger, and Marley have already pulled down the flag. Hastings is next. He'll be turning in his diner's card before noon. Take my word for it.
Well, you mean they're out of business?
Yep. And we're just starting the jet fuel, pumping it in. When will we really start to travel? Va-boom!
Like that. Right through the gold barrier.
But it doesn't make sense. I did the research on all our products, and we ought to have about 1/8 of the market, not all of it.
I planned a campaign for Vanish, but I didn't think it would sell like it's been going all morning. Why, 2 stores in Brooklyn are sold out already.
You know what? Something is wrong with the law of averages. You just can't figure on 100% of all sales. And you can't figure on traffic going all the same way, and all boy babies, and all baggage all dumped under one letter.
Oh, don't give me that talk about law of averages. That's just another law made to be broken. We're going to stock the shelves of every store in this country shoulder high. The other agencies can pass out severance pay. We'll have a Christmas bonus that'll put a caddy in everyone's garage. And, Danny, you're in for a very pleasant surprise when you pick up your paycheck on Friday, if you know what I mean.
Now, by lunchtime, everyone knew that something was going on. It was all around you. The traffic on Madison Avenue was jammed going downtown, just a few cars coming uptown. One store would be packed to the door, another store almost empty. There were extras on the street with headline stories from all over the world. Strange, half funny, half frightening stories.
Dateline, London. There was an unusual scene at the famed Ascot Club this noon when Sir John Avery Avery answered the waiter in the dining room.
No mutton! No
I beg your pardon. No mutton? Well, my good man, I have been having lunch at this club every Thursday since 1921. And every Thursday I've had mutton for lunch. And do you mean to stand there and tell me that...
No mutton, Sir John.
Deadline, Lucerne, Switzerland. It is with considerable embarrassment that we are forced to report that last night at exactly 12 o'clock midnight, every Swiss watch and clock in Lucerne stopped. In an interview with this reporter, Francis Bassler, president of the world-famous Bassler Watch Company, said...
I can't explain it. There is no explanation. Pardon me, but do you happen to have the correct time?
Dateline, Moscow. It has been reported to the Kremlin that this morning nobody rode to work on the subway. Everyone walked to work. Since it is known throughout the world that the subway was invented by Russia, and since Moscow has the most beautiful subway system ever built, it is hereby ordered that everyone will ride the subway on their way home from work. Everyone, that is an order.
I went back to the office after lunch. The place was still spinning like a king-size squirrel cage, and most of the executives were walking around with dollar signs in their eyes. Then I heard a sound which seemed a little out of place in all the money-making merriment, and I saw Elaine dabbing at her eyes and trying not to let me see her face. Well, look, anyone interested in a gray flannel shoulder, it's available at the moment.
It's nothing, Mr. Nolan, please. I'm sorry. I'm just being very foolish.
A woman's prerogative and privilege. Nothing I can do to help?
Not unless you'd like to go down to Washington and blow up the Pentagon. I just got a cable from Jerry. He's my fiancé, stationed in Germany. His Christmas leave has been canceled. We were going to be married.
Any reason for his leave being canceled?
The wire didn't say. It just said, all leaves canceled. Oh, who wants to get married, April?
I suddenly had a sort of strange feeling in the pit of my stomach. I guess maybe that was the first time I began to feel a little frightened. The world seemed to be slowly sliding off its axis. And all at once I wanted to be with Maggie and Adele, and in my own apartment where I could shut the door and feel reasonably safe. I walked home, and as I turned the corner into our apartment, I saw a lot of equipment spread all over the pavement, hoses and pumps. The super was talking to a bunch of workmen as I passed.
How do you like this, Mr. Nolan? Believe it or not, every one of them washing machines in the basement overflowed. Almost floated the whole place off the block.
I walked into the lobby and there was a sign saying all elevators out of order. I climbed the 10 flights to my apartment. Adele met me at the door.
Mr. Blair has called 3 times. He wants you to come back to the office.
Well, if he calls again, I'm not here. I don't want to talk to him.
Johnny, what's happening? What's going wrong? I went to the supermarket this afternoon, and there wasn't a clerk in the place. They all stayed home.
Yeah, that figures.
And there was a Santa Claus near Herald Square. He had to have an armed guard escort him to the bank. He'd collected so much money. But none of the others had collected a cent.
You know, this is what I told Mr. Blair at the meeting, but he wouldn't listen. I told him that something has happened to the law of averages. Has the hospital called yet?
Not yet.
Oh, I'll get it.
Telegram for Mr. Nolan. Sign here.
Okay. Here you are.
Thanks, mister.
Danny, it isn't about Maggie. Is it? Oh, Danny, what is it?
It's from the commanding officer of my reserve unit. I've been ordered to report for active duty in 24 hours.
And so, tonight, a special emergency session of the United Nations has been called to deal with the present world crisis. The issues are these. If war should come, the casualties could very easily happen only to one side. Our side or the enemy's. In every country, orders for total mobilization have been issued. By dawn, the world will be an armed camp, waiting. The enemy powers have sent their ultimatum to the United Nations. Surrender or perish. Will we call their bluff, or can we afford to take a chance and oppose them? Tonight's vote will answer that all-important question. So, stay tuned.
Well, there's the answer for the telegram, and the reason why Elaine and her soldier in Germany won't be getting married this Christmas. Now, this is what I've been afraid might happen. All of a sudden, something which is very funny becomes very serious. As serious as survival of the fittest. Or the luckiest.
Oh, Danny, don't talk like that.
Yeah, the day the law of averages ran out. That's what they'll call it in the history books. If there is any history after tomorrow. Well, I hope Maggie and I don't have a boy.
Hello? Yes? Danny, it's the hospital.
Nolan, would you like to listen to the radio? We've got one on in the recreation room.
No, thanks.
Awful, isn't it? I mean, about the UN.
Have they voted yet?
No, sir, not yet.
Danny, may I see you for a minute?
I'll call you as soon as anything happens. About the baby, I mean.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Blair?
I tried to get you this afternoon.
Yeah, I know.
I wanted to talk to you, Danny.
What for? Break some more laws?
Don't you know what's happened? The agency's out of business, Danny.
What do you mean?
We haven't a single account left. Everything's down the drain. Gone.
So, it's happened to you, too.
The clients decided they didn't need an agency anymore. With everything selling like wildfire, why have salesmen? Why have advertising? Why radio, TV? Why an agency? They all cancel their contracts. All of them.
What do you plan to do?
Well, under the circumstances, nothing. I'm going to the Pentagon in the morning, see if they need me. Later, when this is all over, maybe I'll try again. There's a chance of getting a foothold, even in the ad business.
You mean you're starting to believe that there is such a thing as chance?
Well, sure there is. Well, at least they used to be.
But not anymore.
It'll come back.
How? You're going to make it come back? You didn't want anything to do with it before because it got in your way. And you got me hoping to beat it, too. Now look what's happened.
Mr. Nolan?
Yes?
Doctor told me to tell you that it's a boy.
A boy?
Yes, sir.
What are we going to do, Danny? What's
the matter, Danny? You can't have everything you want, you know.
Well, yes, Doctor, but... A boy.
The other baby's fine, too. First twins we've had all day. A healthy boy and a beautiful, beautiful girl.
After I'd seen Maggie and the twins, Mr. Blair and I left the hospital together. And I can't tell you how good it was to see the traffic running in both directions again on Lexington Avenue. I was even happy when we couldn't get a cab. Mr. Blair walked east, and I started west across town. I really didn't understand everything that had happened, what it meant. 24 hours out of our lives with nothing working right. Why had it happened? Mr. Blair had been so sure of a golden future, so sure you could force your luck, so sure that laws were made to be broken. And now the laws were back again and things were normal again. Christmas was on its way, singing down from a gray-blue spire of a lonely Madison Avenue church. And then just for a few moments, I had a glimpse of what it all might have meant. Maybe we can twist fate to get our own way, but we'd better be careful. For you break a law of nature, you do so at your own peril. And you better hope that the law you've broken remains in force to be broken again. This day was the shadow of what would happen if we all followed separate tracks and denied each other an equal chance. That was the warning of the big event.
You have been listening to the CBS Radio Workshop and the Big Event, an original radio fantasy by Gloria Dapper and Draper Lewis. Musical score composed by Ben Ludlow, conducted by Alfredo Antonini, and produced and directed in New York by Paul Roberts. William Redfield was heard as Danny Nolan, Ralph Bell as Mr. Blair, Ethel Owen as Mrs. Robertson, and Roger DeCoven as Dr. Johnson. Others in the cast included Elaine Rost, Ivor Francis, Herm Dinkin, and Ruby Dee. This is the CBS Radio Network.
So rapid has been the advance of 20th century science in the diagnosis and cure of disease that one pictures men of medicine as seizing avidly on any discovery which contributes even slightly to their understanding the human body. And in general, such a picture is accurate. But what shall be said of Dr. Kilner's remarkable experiment? An experiment which might have revolutionized the whole field of medicine had not doctors and laboratory experts chosen to ignore it.
The record of Dr. W.J. Kilner's astonishing discovery may be found in a book entitled The Human Atmosphere. There he recounts how, on a summer's day 12 years before, he happened, by the merest chance, to stumble on a strange and inexplicable fact. He and his assistant were working on a routine experiment in the laboratory of St. Thomas Hospital in London.
All right, Alex. I'm ready for the viewing screen now.
It's got some sort of a dye on it, hasn't it, Doctor?
Yes, I stained it myself this morning with dicyanine. Hold the screen up, Alex. Let's see if it's dye. Wait a moment. What in the devil's name is that?
What?
Behind the screen.
It's my arm.
But what's around your arm?
Around it? Why, nothing.
Nothing you can see, perhaps. Alex, I want you to disrobe. I want to see your whole body behind that screen.
The laboratory assistant, completely baffled by Dr. Kilner's sudden intense excitement, removed his clothes and stepped behind the viewing screen.
A sort of an aura, all different colors, extending beyond the surface of your skin. The human body, at least your body, throws off a strange kind of substance.
In the first feverish flush of discovery, Dr. Kilner had no doubt that he had correctly interpreted the amazing thing he'd seen. But an hour later, he began to wonder. And so he summoned one of his patients from a ward in the hospital and asked him to stand behind the screen.
I'm not crazy, am I, Alex? You see it too, don't you?
Sort of a... well, sort of an atmosphere all around his body.
Exactly. A human atmosphere.
But why is it so different up there around his chest? The radiations. They're a different color and a different texture altogether.
By George, so they are. I'm sure they weren't like that when you... Good Lord. This man's a tubercular. And the aura's modified only in the region around his lungs. That screen's given us a new way to diagnose disease.
Word of the doctor's discovery spread rapidly through the hospital.
The human atmosphere.
You saw the radiations?
How do I know they aren't the properties of the screen itself?
Alex, you ready with the other patient?
Yes, doctor.
Help him to sit up behind the screen. If the radiations were just an optical illusion, if they were created by the screen itself, they'd always be present, wouldn't they, Doctor? Well, then, take a look at the man who's there now. Do you see any aura?
No, I don't. How do you explain that, Kilner?
It's simple enough. You see, The body Alex is holding up in that chair happens to be a corpse.
Dr. Kilmer made hundreds of difficult and invariably accurate diagnoses with the aid of his viewing screens. And yet, the record of Dr. Kilmer's work lies ignored, forgotten by contemporary science. This fact, like the fact of the remarkable experiment itself, can only be regarded as incredible but true.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock rock, 5, 7, 6, 9, 8 o'clock rock, 9, 13, 14, 17, or, just a minute, or to hell with it.
And finally for tonight, from September the 8th of 1948, is an episode of The Unexpected, The Winfield Diamond.
From Hollywood, Vinnie Barnes in The Unexpected.
The Unexpected.
The Unexpected. Life is filled with the unexpected. Happy, romantic, tragic, and mysterious endings to our most ordinary actions. Dreams come true, or dreams are shattered by sudden twists of fate in The Unexpected. Who knows what strange drama may happen tomorrow, or an hour from now, or in just a moment? Who knows what destiny has in store for the lady down the street, the fellow at the next desk, or for you, yourself? Who knows? Listen in just a moment for The Unexpected. Vinnie Barnes, famous motion picture and stage star, in a drama of the unexpected, titled The Winfield Diamond.
The whole thing looked like a setup. I was sure it would be easier than stealing the Kenworthy emeralds or the Knight Sapphire I had lifted in Monte Carlo. But this theft would pay off with the biggest prize of all. 63 carats, blue, white, and flawless. The Winfield Diamond. The first break came one afternoon about 6 weeks ago. I was strolling past the Winfield Mansion on Long Island, making a mental map of the grounds. Suddenly, I heard footsteps behind me, and Opportunity, white-haired and dignified, called out sharply.
I say, miss, can you type?
I beg your pardon?
I said, are you familiar with a typewriter? If you aren't, I don't see how you can fill the job.
What job?
As Mr. Winfield's secretary. That's why you have to type. He sends dozens of letters every day. They aren't important, of course, but it amuses him to keep up a tremendous correspondence, you understand.
Well, I'm afraid I really don't.
Oh, come now, it's really frightfully simple. Mr. Winfield wants you to work for him as his secretary.
But why me, if I'm not asking too much?
He's been watching you through his bedroom window. You really can't blame him. Nothing else for the poor old man to do. And he finds you attractive, extremely attractive. So when Miss Adams resigned this morning, Mr. Winfield decided on you. I expect you'd better take the job. Even if you can't type, we'll manage it somehow. Well, come along. Mr. Winfield will be most annoyed if I keep him waiting.
I shook my head with complete bewilderment. For the past 7 days, I had been trying to figure an entrance into the Winfield home. And now the butler with the English accent was actually opening the door for me. Mr. Winfield was an invalid and had been confined to his bedroom for years. The room was smaller than the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria, but not much.
Come over here. By my bed. Yes, yes, that's better. What are you staring at, Liggett? Go downstairs. I don't want to see you again today. Tell cook I want shortcake for supper. Strawberry. Go on. What are you waiting for?
Yes, Mr. Winfield.
Don't guess me, you hypocrite. You never do a thing I tell you.
Yes, Mr. Winfield.
And don't forget shortcake. Raspberry shortcake. Now, what do you want?
Well, I believe you need a secretary, Mr. Winfield.
What? Oh, yes. You're Miss Adams.
No, I'm Miss Brent. Hilda Brent.
Don't argue with me.
Well, Miss Adams left this morning, Mr. Winfield.
Of course. Glad she's gone. Couldn't type. Nothing but hunt and peck. Two fingers, you know. Well, take a letter.
I'm sorry. I don't have a pad and pencil.
What? Oh, no? Well, go talk to Liggett. He'll take care of you. Tell you about salary and all that, and you'll have a room here in the house. Like to have people here in the house. That fool curse on the diamond doesn't frighten me. Just don't like to be alone. Well, go see, Liggett. Don't waste time. I'm not paying you to stand around.
Yes, Mr. Winfield.
You'll have dinner here. We're having shortcake, you know. I'm very fond of shortcake. You'll stay for dinner, huh?
I stayed for dinner. The dessert was bread pudding, but Mr. Winfield didn't seem to notice the difference. The next morning, I moved into the house. As soon as I was settled, I made a brief survey of my new residence. But I couldn't find the safe. Then about lunchtime, I thought I was on the trail. I found a small locked room on the third floor. I used a hairpin, so it took me only a few minutes to spring the catch.
Looking for something, Miss Brent? Perhaps I can be of assistance.
Why, yes, Mr. Liggett. I need a ribbon for the typewriter.
Of course. Be glad to get it. Keep the supplies downstairs. Funny thing, though, you're coming in here. Thought my door was locked. Very odd. Could have sworn it was locked.
After that, I had to be more careful. And it wasn't quite as simple as I had expected. Liggett always seemed to be somewhere in the background. And Mr. Winfield kept me jumping as his personal secretary.
Take a letter, Miss Brent, to George Bernard Shaw. Dear George, frankly, I am disgusted with your attitude. To the president of the Garden Club, Broken Barrel, Montana. Dear sir, I definitely do not agree with you and your nasturtiums. They are not the flower of old age. To the Maharaja of Jaipur. Dear Dickie, I understand you have been having rain. This does not come as a surprise to me.
After 4 weeks, I was still as far away from the diamond as ever. I didn't even know where the safe was, and all I had to show for my time and trouble were calloused fingers and ragged nerves. I was at the end of a fraying rope.
Miss Brent, I want you, Miss Brent.
Yes, Mr. Winfield.
Do you know the combination of the safe downstairs?
Why, no, I don't. Of course I don't.
Why not? You've been here long enough.
Well, you've never told me. I didn't even know where the safe is, Mr. Winfield.
Oh, any fool would know the safe is downstairs. That's where I keep the diamond downstairs. It isn't really cursed, you know, but I am going to sell it.
You're going to sell the Winfield diamond?
Yep, made up my mind. It's been nothing but bad luck. Going to send it to England tomorrow. Had an offer, a very good offer.
Are you serious?
Of course. I want you to send the diamond to England. Here, this slip of paper gives the address. Send it by some sort of guard. You take care of all that.
Why, yes, sir. And the safe?
It's downstairs, behind the big picture. Ugly thing, that picture. Ought to get rid of it. No! Need it to cover the safe.
And the combination, Mr. Winfield. What's the combination?
I never can remember. Look on the paper. Wrote it down for you. Under the address. Don't get them mixed up. Address on top. Combination on the bottom.
No, Mr. Winfield. I won't get them mixed up. At last, I knew the safe, the combination, everything. It was going to be a snap, so fantastically simple that it almost hurt my pride. I waited a few hours until it was dark and I was alone in the house except for Mr. Winfield. He was upstairs in his canopied bed, dictating in his sleep. I walked into the library cautiously. I didn't need to turn on the light. I knew where I was going. I slid the portrait of Mr. Winfield's great aunt aside. And the old lady's eyes seemed to stare at me a little suspiciously. But I smiled right back. The combination was simple, except that the figures in the London address were the ones that opened the safe. Even in the darkness, I could see the diamond. It was a cold, white lump that caught many faceted fires from the ray of moonlight that wandered in from between the heavy drapes. Now I had it at last. After all the waiting and planning, I had it. The full 63 carats, curse included. I reached out my hand and my fingers were trembling as they touched $500,000.
Well, well, well. Good evening, Hilda.
Oh, what are you doing here, Mr. Liggett?
Nothing at all. I hope I haven't interrupted. Came in early, you know, the rain and all that.
I was just opening the safe for Mr. Winfield.
Oh, were you? I hadn't noticed. It's so dark in here.
Yes, he wanted me to get the diamond. He's shipping it to England tomorrow.
Oh, my, is he off on that again?
You mean he isn't really selling it?
Oh, my dear girl, of course not. It's just one of his whims. I suggest you put the jewel back in the safe.
Why, yes, of course, Mr. Liggett. I suppose I should.
Come to think of it, Miss Brent, I don't understand why you were removing the diamond at this hour. Even if Mr. Winfield were planning to sell the stone, you couldn't ship it tonight.
Well,
you know, under the circumstances, I'm forced to doubt your motives, Miss Brent. Why, who knows? You might even have been planning to wear the diamond to a party or some such place. It's possible.
Well, I didn't think that Mr. Winfield would mind. I was just going to...
Oh, we can't have that. He would mind. He would indeed. He might lose it. It might even be stolen. Think of the risk. Mr. Winfield would be furious if he knew. You'd best pack and leave immediately, tonight if possible. There's no telling what Mr. Winfield may do when he finds out.
Yes. Very well, Mr. Liggett, if you say so.
You've made a wise decision, Hilda, very wise. As a matter of fact, the job wouldn't have lasted much longer anyway. Mr. Winfield was saying to me only this morning that your typing was quite unsatisfactory. Hunt and peck, you know. Entirely unsatisfactory.
I packed my things and left the house that night. Under the circumstances, I had no choice. So far, Mr. Liggett hadn't really suspected, but he might. And I decided I'd rather spend the evening hitchhiking back to New York than in jail. I was through with the Winfield diamond, and I was going to forget it forever. Forever.
You think the story is over, don't you? But wait. Fate takes a hand. Wait for the unexpected. And now for the surprising conclusion of The Winfield Diamond, a Hamilton Whitney production written by Robert Libet and Frank Burt and directed by Frank K. Danzig.
It took me 2 hours to catch a ride. My driver was a sleek, shiny-faced salesman with a suitcase full of samples and an unfortunate addiction to news broadcasts.
Now it seems clear that the president had no comment to make. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here is a bulletin just received. From Long Island comes word that the famous Winfield diamond has been stolen. The thief has been identified as the internationally famous jewel robber, Light-Fingered Liggett, who had posed for several months as the Winfield butler. It has been determined that Liggett had a female accomplice who had been introduced into the Winfield house as a secretary. Police have blockaded all highways in the vicinity, and an arrest is expected momentarily.
And so here I am. It's damp, drafty, and no matter what they tell you, there are mice. You know, I really don't think it's a bit fair. Not a bit. Why should I be in jail for a jewel robbery I didn't commit and Liggett free somewhere in Europe with $500,000? It's really not cricket, you know.
The Winfield Diamond starred Binnie Barnes. Listen in again soon when another of your favorite motion picture stars meets the unexpected. This program was transcribed in Hollywood.
Star Mother. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Jan Morrison. Star Mother by Robert F. Young. A touching story of the most enduring love in all eternity. That night, her son was the first star. She stood motionless in the garden, one hand pressed against her heart, watching him rise above the fields where he had played as a boy, where he had worked as a young man, and she wondered whether he was thinking of those fields now, whether he was thinking of her standing alone in the April night with her memories, whether he was thinking of the verandaed house behind her, with its empty rooms and silent halls that, once upon a time, had been his birthplace. Higher still and higher he rose in the southern sky, and then, when he had reached his zenith, he dropped swiftly down past the dark edge of the earth and disappeared from sight. A boy grown up too soon, riding round and round the world on a celestial carousel, encased in an airtight metal capsule, in an airtight metal chariot. Why don't they leave the stars alone, she thought. Why don't they leave the stars to God? The general's second telegram came early the next morning. Explorer 12 doing splendidly. Expect to bring your son down sometime tomorrow. She went about her work as usual, collecting the eggs and allocating them in their cardboard boxes, then setting off in the station wagon on her Tuesday morning run. She had expected a deluge of questions from her customers. She was not disappointed. Is Terry really way up there all alone, Martha? Aren't you scared, Martha? I do hope they can get him back down all right, Martha. She supposed it must have given them quite a turn to have their egg woman change into a star mother overnight. She hadn't expected the TV interview, though, and she would have avoided it if it had been politely possible. But what could she do when the line of cars and trucks pulled into the drive and the technicians got out and started setting up their equipment in the backyard? What could she say when the suave young man came up to her and said, "We want you to know that we're all very proud of your boy up there, ma'am, and we hope you'll do us the honor of answering a few questions." Most of the questions concerned Terry, as was fitting. From the way the suave young man asked them, though, she got the impression that he was trying to prove that her son was just like any other average American boy, and such just didn't happen to be the case. But whenever she opened her mouth to mention, say, how he had used to study till all hours of the night, or how difficult it had been for him to make friends because of his shyness, or the fact that he had never gone out for football, Whenever she started to mention any of these things, the suave young man was in great haste to interrupt her and to twist her words by re-questioning into a different meaning altogether, till Terry's behavior pattern seemed to coincide with the behavior pattern which the suave young man apparently considered the norm, but which, if followed, Martha was sure, would produce not young men bent on exploring space, but young men bent on exploring trivia. A few of the questions concerned herself. Was Terry her only child? Yes. What had happened to her husband? He was killed in the Korean War. What did she think of the new law granting star mothers top priority on any and all information relating to their sons? I think it's a fine law. It's too bad they couldn't have shown similar humanity toward the war mothers of World War II. It was late in the afternoon by the time the TV crew got everything repacked into their cars and trucks and made their departure. Martha fixed herself a light supper, then donned an old suede jacket of Terry's and went out into the garden to wait for the sun to go down. According to the timetable the general had outlined in his first telegram, Terry's first Tuesday night passage wasn't due to occur until 9:05. But it seemed only right that she should be outside when the stars started to come out. Presently they did, and she watched them wink on, one by one, in the deepening darkness of the sky. She'd never been much of a one for the stars. Most of her life she'd been much too busy on Earth to bother with things celestial. She could remember when she was much younger and Bill was courting her, looking up at the moon sometimes, and once in a while when a star fell, making a wish. But this was different. It was different because now she had a personal interest in the sky, a new affinity with its myriad inhabitants. And how bright they became when you kept looking at them. They seemed to come alive, almost, pulsing brilliantly down out of the blackness of the night. And they were different colors, too, she noticed with a start. Some of them were blue and some were red. Others were yellow, green, orange. It grew cold in the April garden, and she could see her breath. There was a strange crispness, a strange clarity about the night that she had never known before. She glanced at her watch, was astonished to see that the hands indicated 9:02. Where had the time gone? Tremulously, she faced the southern horizon and saw her Terry appear in his shining chariot, riding up the star-pebbled path of his orbit, a star in his own right, dropping swiftly now, down, down and out of sight beyond the dark, wheeling mass of the earth. She took a deep, proud breath, realized that she was wildly waving her hand, and let it fall slowly to her side. Make a wish, she thought, like a little girl, and she wished him pleasant dreams and a safe return, and wrapped the wish in all her love and cast it starward. Sometime tomorrow, the general's telegram had said. That meant sometime today. She rose with the sun and fed the chickens, fixed and ate her breakfast, collected the eggs and put them in their cardboard boxes, then started out on her Wednesday morning run. My land, Martha, I don't see how you stand it with him way up there. Doesn't it get on your nerves? Yes, yes, it does. Martha, when are they bringing him back down? Today. Today. It must be wonderful being a star mother, Martha. Yes, it is, in a way. Wonderful and terrible. If only he can last it out for a few more hours, she thought. If only they can bring him down safe and sound. Then the vigil will be over, and some other mother can take over the awesome responsibility of having a son become a star. If only... The general's third telegram arrived that afternoon. Regret to inform you that meteorite impact on satellite hull severely damaged capsule detachment mechanism, making ejection impossible. We'll make every effort to find another means of accomplishing your son's return. Terry, see the little boy playing beneath the maple tree, moving his tiny cars up and down the tiny streets of his make-believe village. The little boy, his fuzz of hair gold in the sunlight, his cherub cheeks pink in the summer wind. Terry. Up the lane the blue-denimed young man walks, swinging his thin, tanned arms, his long legs making near-grown-up strides over the sun-seared grass, the sky blue and bright behind him, the song of cicada rising and falling in the hazy September air. Terry. Probably won't get a chance to write you again before takeoff, but don't worry, Ma. The Explorer 12 is the greatest bird they ever built. Nothing short of a direct meteorite hit can hurt it, and the odds are 1,000,000 to 1. Why don't they leave the stars alone? Why don't they leave the stars to God? The afternoon shadows lengthened on the lawn, and the sun grew red and swollen over the western hills. Martha fixed supper, tried to eat and couldn't. After a while, when the light began to fade, she slipped into Terry's jacket and went outside. Slowly, the sky darkened, and the stars began to appear. At length, her star appeared, but its swift passage blurred before her eyes. Tires crunched on the gravel then, and headlights washed the darkness from the drive. A car door slammed. Martha did not move. Please, God, she thought, let it be Terry, even though she knew that it couldn't possibly be Terry. Footsteps sounded behind her, paused. Someone coughed softly. She turned, then, good evening, ma'am. She saw the circlet of stars on the gray epaulette. She saw the stern, handsome face. She saw the dark, tired eyes, and she knew. Even before he spoke again, she knew. The same meteorite that damaged the ejection mechanism, ma'am, it penetrated the capsule, too. We didn't find out till just a while ago, but there was nothing we could have done anyway. Are you all right, ma'am?
Yes, I'm all right.
I wanted to express my regrets personally. I know how you must feel.
It's all right.
We will, of course, make every effort to bring back his remains so that he can have a fitting burial on Earth.
No, she said. I beg your pardon, ma'am?
She raised her eyes to the patch of sky where her son had passed in his shining metal sarcophagus. Sirius blossomed there, blue, white, and beautiful. She raised her eyes still higher and beheld the vast parterre of Orion, with its central motif of vivid forget-me-nots, its far-flung blooms of Betelgeuse and Rigel, of Bellatrix and Saif. And higher yet, and there flamed the exquisite flower-beds of Taurus and Gemini. There burgeoned the riotous wealth of the crab. There lay the pulsing petals of the Pleiades. And down the elliptic garden path, wafted by a stellar breeze, drifted the ochre rose of Mars. No, she said again. The general had raised his eyes, too. Now, slowly, he lowered them. I think I understand, ma'am. And I'm glad that's the way you want it. Stars are beautiful tonight, aren't they?
More beautiful than they've ever been, she said.
After the general had gone, she looked up once more at the vast and variegated garden of the sky where her son lay buried. Then she turned and walked slowly back to the memoried house. The end of Star Mother by Robert F. Young.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention at the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the Internet, and there's a good deal of ancillary material there, more details about the shows, and even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.